Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington, El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, November 7th, 2025. We're also here on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, as the U.S. continues to escalate political tensions against Venezuela with the threat of military force, we put the spotlight on neighboring Trinidad and Tobago to examine their role in enabling U.S. imperialism. And so joining us on the show today is Erica Keynes, who is a freelance writer and organizer in both Baltimore and the DMV. She's also the field operations and membership coordinator of the Black Alliance for Peace. She wrote an article back in January for the Black Agenda Report entitled Bound by Imperialism, Trinidad's Role in U.S. Agenda. She joins us on the show for the first time. Welcome to the show, Erica Keynes.
Thank you for having me.
So as I said at the beginning of my introduction, that you wrote this article on Trinidad and Tobago back in January. Now, obviously, both you and I could not have foreseen recent events between the U.S. and Venezuela. And we'll certainly get to that during the course of this conversation. But as a frame of reference to the political state of affairs in neighboring Trinidad and Tobago, which is one of the closest neighbors to Venezuela in the Caribbean, before we get to all those things, can you tell us about the state of emergency that was implemented in Trinidad and Tobago way back in January?
Yeah, before I do that, I think it's important to give a bit of context, because when it was implemented in January, that was under another political party. So now currently they are extending the state of emergency. So there are two main political parties, the People's National Movement, PNM, and the United National Congress, UNC. So in January, under PNM, under the, what would we call him? At the time, the sitting prime minister had stepped down. So they had a transitional prime minister right before the elections, where we have Carmo, who is now prime minister. But I think it's important to get that context to really understand how we got here, especially with the extended state of emergency, because Trinidad and Tobago, and I think with any two-party dominant democracies, We see that similar to here or adjacent to here, both parties are inefficient. And so as in the case of here in the U.S. and in much of the Caribbean, we see that the inefficiency of both parties, which are the main parties or the primary parties, it breeds a sort of apolitical activity from the people. So what we're seeing, or what we have seen, even during the elections, given that the purpose of the state of the emergency was, given the uptick in crime, if you will, that was occurring in Trinidad and Tobago. And so because folks felt like it wasn't getting dealt with through PNM, even with the state of emergency, they voted for UNC. But I do think it's very important, especially as we talk about the role that the current prime minister plays, that we understand that it was a very low voter turnout, right? So people are dismayed in Trinidad and Tobago by both parties, primarily because, again, the ineffective nature of both parties. So like I mentioned, it was an alarming surge in violent crime in 2024. I think it was over 600 deaths. And that is not something that has ever been seen in Trinidad and Tobago. And so it's, you know, historical, if you will. And that led to a state of emergency rather at the top of the year. And so the state of emergency in Trinidad and Tobago was presented by both parties, by PNM at the top of the year and UNC now, as necessary punitive measures to combat a severe crime wave. So there has been overwhelming rhetoric and narrative around crime, quote unquote. But I think it's important to have a critical perspective, because the state of emergency, it's a superficial and politically expedient response that deliberately ignores the root causes of crime, or at least the root causes of the crisis, similar to here. So we're seeing that it's not addressing some really deep-seated structural inequality. So we have high unemployment in Trinidad and Tobago, eviscerated public services, you know, corruption in government, if you will, to some aspects. And then there's a profound kind of social despair created by these neoliberal policies, which have been the actual drivers of crime. But instead, you see, not dissimilar to here, there's an opting for militarized suppression instead of investing in social welfare, education, economic justice. So the state is treating a symptom while exacerbating the disease, if you will. So the state of emergency in Trinidad and Tobago is functioning as a tool of social control. And so it's masking state failure and aligning with a broader sort of regional trend of using quote unquote security to justify this basic erosion of civil liberties and the avoidance of real meaningful transformative social policy.
I think we're going to be making a lot of similar parallels during the course of this conversation between Trinidad and Tobago in the U.S. when it comes to economic inequalities. Now, you mentioned her in passing, so let's bring it up. Can you tell people who may not know who is Prime Minister Kamla Prasad Bisesayer in Trinidad and Tobago? From my understanding, based on the things that I read in the lead up to today's conversation, she comes across to me, at the very least, as the type of politician that maintains the exact status quo that you just described. Am I correct in making that assessment?
Yeah. Well, I think she's a very interesting personality, if you will. This will be her second time as prime minister. She was elected initially as the first woman prime minister. So she was in office from 2010 to 2015 before PNM overwhelmingly won and took back. So she's presented in that sort of progressive way, especially more recently. She's kind of, when she won the election at the top of the year, well, in spring, rather, you can see, especially on social media, the sort of comparatives between her and Mia Motley, which is Barbados' prime minister. Folks are familiar with her. She makes a lot of grandiose speeches about the need for the Caribbean to have its own sovereignty, etc. But they were being compared because there is a lot of men, if you will, as prime ministers across the Caribbean. So to see these two pillars, these two women, there was a lot of fanfare. But, you know, we could argue that they're nothing alike and similar in some other ways if we look at geopolitical policies. But she herself, I think, even with this first female prime minister kind of title, she's presenting in this context, not just like as a political and national leader, but I do think it's important that we understand that she is, if not overtly, an example of a comprador elite. Because she, we talk about compradors, we understand them as like local actors, or even here domestically, we say like the Black misleadership class, right? So their power is dependent on aligning with external agendas, never with like the people. So her political identity is characterized, like we should really understand her really as a far right politician. And this was more than evident. Well, when she first held office, obviously her reign initially ended in 2015. And then we had Trump come into office. She was one of the main supporters of Juan Guaido. So she has no sitting office. Yeah, she has no sitting office. And she is calling for, you know, the recognition of Juan Guaido as the rightful leader of Venezuela. So this is just to put into context of where we are now in the geopolitical frame, as you mentioned, the tensions with Venezuela and the role that Trinidad and Tobago is playing, because I think it's important to highlight that this escalation is happening under someone who was already kind of with, you know, she was already going with the grain with the U.S. agenda.
I would say to you that several months ago, we did a show on U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio going to the Caribbean, and he was met with a little bit of mockery and resistance by a few Caribbean leaders. One of them was the aforementioned Mia Motley that you mentioned when it came to sort of bullying from Marco Rubio to several Caribbean countries. With Bissacer, on the other hand, there is footage of her being cozy and being friendly with Marco Rubio, which again sort of underlines the greater issue that we'll address later on in the program, which is this escalation between the U.S. and Venezuela that could it lead to military force? We certainly hope not. Now, while one of the main reasons for U.S. hostilities towards Venezuela is about oil, Trinidad and Tobago also has its own natural resource industry that seems both lucrative and vulnerable to the instability of recent events. Could you explain to us the complex relationship between Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela regarding oil? And I say this because as recently as last month, I think it was Al Jazeera that reported that as of right now, the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago is, quote unquote, persona non grata by the Venezuelan government. So could you explain this complex relationship regarding oil?
Yeah, so I do want to just conclude here about Kamala, because to your point about even what we're seeing about the cozying up, when Trump won the day of his inauguration, she made, you know, she sent the letter or made a statement saying it was a great day for democracy, and also vehemently rejecting, quote unquote, like far right, I mean, excuse me, far left extreme insanity. So this is the just to kind of put her into a context. So when you say that she's cozy to Marco Rubio in photos and images, this is because she's aligned with the sort of rhetoric that's coming from the MAGA administration. Yes. So when we talk about the relationship with Trinidad and Tobago, Trinidad and Tobago's relationship with Venezuelan energy is really, I would say, a tragic case of geopolitics sort of trumping geoeconomics, right? Because Venezuela possesses, you know, the world's largest proven oil reserves. And yes, Trinidad and Tobago is also, especially the Caribbean, it is what makes it, I guess, a viable, it makes its position viable in CARICOM, right? Because of the amount of oil that it holds in comparison to the rest of the Caribbean. But it also makes it, again, a target for partnership with the U.S. and for those particular reasons. But I do think when we look at the sort of dragon deal, there is still a dependency, at least a relationship that is developed between Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela that has been now, I think it's undermined by this process, because I think Venezuela just pulled that back. But Venezuela possessing the world's largest proven oil reserves is a fact that makes it a target. And with Trinidad and Tobago being that close, my great-grandfather is Venezuelan. And you know, there's a joke.
Oh, really?
That you can swim essentially to Venezuela from Trinidad and Tobago, right? So when we see these extrajudicial killings that are happening on the Caribbean Sea, when bodies are floating onto the shores of Trinidad and Tobago, it is because it is that close. And I do also think that deal in itself, what we see also like similarly, like the Petrocaribe, like it shows the kind of geopolitical threat that Venezuela possesses. Because while Trinidad and Tobago has oil, Venezuela has the largest oil reserve, especially in the region, right? So it makes it a significant player. So then it becomes like, what does that mean for Trinidad and Tobago and this relationship? What does it mean with the relationships that we are forming in the Americas and in the region? So it is just it's a paradox, if you will, like caught between geographic reality and geopolitical kind of subservience. Because geographically and economically, Trinidad and Tobago's energy sector has a natural synergy with Venezuela's vast oil and gas reserves. But this relationship is kind of currently poisoned by Trinidad and Tobago's current foreign policy alignment with the U.S. So that context kind of portrays the U.S. offensive against Venezuela as a central strategy to enforce hemispheric or regional hegemony, using these sort of false narratives, designating the Bolivarian government as a narco state, and that aligns with this quote-unquote rise in crime in Trinidad and Tobago. So you see how things are being set up in these kind of ways. So in this framework, the Trinidad and Tobago government just abandoned all stance of regional solidarity, any kind of anti-colonial principle, any anti-invasion stance that the Caribbean more or less has, just for complicity with U.S. objectives. So instead of pursuing like a sovereign energy partnership, like the Dragon deal that could benefit both nations, the government just validates and facilitates the U.S. military pressure on Venezuela. So, yeah, so it just sacrifices any potential long-term energy and economic security for Trinidad and Tobago in exchange for this sort of patronage and quote-unquote security assistance against crime by the U.S.
This points to the argument I've made in the past whenever I deal with anything related to Venezuela and the U.S. is that any conversation about Venezuela that doesn't include oil is not giving us the whole story. And unfortunately, right, that should include Trinidad and Tobago's relationship with Venezuela as well. Not to mention the fact that there's another country, another Caribbean country, Guyana, that may also be a potential oil producer in the future that also complicates matters in the region. But the one factor that keeps undermining democracy in that region is the United States, hands down. Now, at the heart of your Black Agenda Report article is how the consequences of neoliberalism have been detrimental to the Trinidadian public in spite of the natural resources it possesses. We've covered neoliberalism in this show a million times in various countries, and it can manifest itself in different ways in different regions of the world. How would you describe it in a Caribbean country like Trinidad and Tobago? Because when I look at your Black Agenda Report article, we have to point out as well that in addition to the energy sector that you just described, there's also a tourism industry as well, yes, in places like Trinidad and Tobago, correct?
Yes, and I think that has had a big impact on at least the public sector, because a lot of these things have been privatized. And I do want to also note that much of this has happened under Kamala's first, you know, reign as PM, where land has been sold off, this sort of undermining of unions, etc. But to the point of the sort of two-party dominant democracies, if you will, right, the inefficiency, PNM was able to overwhelmingly win because people were so disheartened by what UNC was doing, and then PNM did nothing, right? And so here we are back with this mad woman, if you will, that is, you know, putting Trinidad and Tobago in a world conversation that has never really actually ever been in, because, you know, this is the island of Carnival, which is, you know, the world's greatest show on earth. So that is how people understand Trinidad and Tobago, Soca, Calypso, you know? They've never heard of Trinidad and Tobago in the context of war. And so this is the conversation that Trinidad and Tobago has found itself in because of the alliance that this current government is having in order to continue to privatize. Because, you know, these small businesses, one could argue there's also sort of cultural, racial tensions that exist. Kamala is Indian. Kamala is also Hindu. Kamala has, you know, it could be argued that Kamala is a Hindu nationalist. There's lots of ties with Modi.
Really?
Modi was just in Trinidad and Tobago. Yes, Modi was just in Trinidad and Tobago.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so right. So the rivers run a bit deep, right? So when we think about this, when you think about these connections and how things are moving in a geopolitical framework and how things are escalating, if you will, even thinking about Modi and even Lula's position on moving or excluding Venezuela from BRICS, right? And then look at the position that Trinidad and Tobago is in now. So I think there's a lot of dynamics at play. But the issue with the neoliberal policies, I think, speaks to this, what I spoke to about crime. The way that crime is being addressed, because things are being privatized, because unions, when we talk about the Caribbean, but more specifically Trinidad and Tobago, there is a labor movement history that has existed in Trinidad and Tobago that has really carried through in the Caribbean. When we talk about the Butler riots and things like that, there's historical labor history. But when we look at labor today or the labor movement today in Trinidad and Tobago, it has been undermined by, you know, neoliberal policies. And then again, when I spoke to quote unquote corruption in government, to the extent that that's happening, right? This is all through and to exacerbate or to benefit from neoliberal policies, right? And all of this is at the expense of the people, the everyday working people. And so we talk about tourism as well. Right now, there is a struggle to keep sandals out of Tobago. And Tobago is the smaller isle, twin isle of Trinidad, which is the main of Trinidad and Tobago. They're twin isles. But yeah, we know the history of sandals, of sandals resort in these countries. And even when that was presented, you could see online, people in Jamaica, people in Barbados, like, don't let sandals come, you know? Talking to folks online, like, this is not a good idea because we understand. Or even the mechanism of carnival. There's a good piece on Hukabinus blog, which I am an editor of, that was written about who is Carnival for. The fact that our people could be priced out of Carnival, their country now at this point, because Carnival is it for? And if we think about the history and the historical moment of Carnival as a rebellion from slavery, right? As a show and form of rebellion, the fact that the everyday working people cannot afford to participate in Carnival, at least not in Port of Spain, the capital, because costumes are ridiculously priced, et cetera, et cetera. But also because it is a tourist attraction. So it is to gain U.S. dollars. So I do think all of these things have an impact in how we're seeing, quote unquote, crime develop. But crime, like I've argued, and it's also in the Black Agenda Report, a piece, Crime, the Trojan Horse for Colonial Control, that the use of crime, as we can see, whether in Trinidad and Tobago, Venezuela, here, it's not a fixed objective reality. It's fluid and it's political. And it presents itself as a potent kind of construct to be weaponized and to serve the interests of the state or like the imperial power, right? So people could just highlight crime to militarize your community, to militarize your country, to blow up, you know, fishing boats in the Caribbean Sea. And none of this has to be actually proven to the sense. And there's no actual thinking about social resolve. Like, what does it take to, you know, resolve this on a social matter? All of the resolution around, quote unquote, crime, whether domestically or globally, has included some sort of military occupation. So we're seeing that here develop with Trinidad and Tobago's solution to these neoliberal policies that have kind of done it. Their social net, and we're seeing that Southcom kind of circling the Caribbean Sea and now the Pacific as a means to handle narco traffic, quote unquote, and yeah, you know, quote terrorism, unquote. Quote unquote, right? And we see it here in DC with the National Guard,
yeah,
right? So, yeah. So all these instances, you know, we really have to consider, what are they speaking about when they say crime, and why is it so easy to say crime and then it's normalized that the response to crime is militarization.
Over the years in this program, I've actually done shows on small Caribbean nations like Barbados, Antigua and Barbuda, Jamaica, St. Lucia, even Trinidad and Tobago. The cloud of tourism, the tourism industry, in one form or another, always rears its ugly head whenever I touch upon subject matter on those countries on this show. And one thing I would conclude, especially in this conversation right now, is that the tourism industry, generally speaking, can sometimes come across as a form of curation where you whitewash and only highlight certain parts of yes. the country's culture while ignoring, as you just mentioned, the history of labor struggles in places like Trinidad and Tobago. And it goes to show, or at least it makes me conclude, that the tourism industry, as we know it, is really a tool or a mechanism of capitalism that undermines yeah. democracy in these Caribbean nations. And dare I say that what you just described, the labor struggle in places like Trinidad and Tobago, dare I say, sounds a lot more interesting than Carnival, because it has the potential to awaken the body politic in places like Trinidad and Tobago. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Erica Keynes, who's a freelance writer and organizer in Baltimore and the DMV. She's also a field operations and membership coordinator of the Black Alliance for Peace. Her January article in the Black Agenda Report is entitled "Bound by Imperialism, Trinidad's Role in U.S. Agenda." This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Which politicians lunge from when they want to control your will. Human rights, they're shouting from the highest hill. For human rights, I will fight with all my might, day and night. Once you have a little schooling, you're bound to see it's fooling. Some of them so damn crooked, they think the public stupid. False promises and false quotes, they give for votes. We want jobs and we want health care. Education, give it that quick. We don't want no political rhetoric. For human rights, I will fight with all my might, day and night. We have sense and we know better. You can't catch we with propaganda.
That was Mighty Sparrow, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. Reminding everyone to go follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about U.S. imperialism in Trinidad and Tobago with Erica Keynes, who's a freelance writer and organizer in Baltimore and the DMV. Her January article in the Black Agenda Report is entitled "Bound by Imperialism, Trinidad's Role in U.S. Agenda." So a large portion of the audience is listening to us, Erica, may not know too much about U.S. intentions in the Caribbean. You mentioned SOUTHCOM as one example, but can you also tell us what is Operation Trade Winds and how it relates to Trinidad and Tobago in these recent times?
I think it's important to note that in 2023, the Monroe Doctrine turned 200 years. I want to highlight that because that has been the consistent strategy for the entire Americas, not specific to Latin America or the Caribbean, but the entire Americas, right? And so I think institutions like the OAS, which is the Organization for American States, or the core group that is, you know, all in Haiti, these kind of institutions serve to uphold that policy where the U.S. treats the Americas at large as its backyard, right? And I think when Biden tried to make a slight correction and say, no, it's the front yard now. But either way, the Americas is not allowed in the house. So it's not allowed to be a part of the house. And so I think that's really important to understand because the U.S. foreign policy with these institutions, but then also with military commands like the U.S. Southern Command, which is one of the longest U.S. commands, you know, since the Panama Canal, came into existence. And then also, which you mentioned, Operation Tradewinds, it all serves to sort of control and capture and expand and retain U.S. hegemony in the region for obvious reasons. I think we talked about the oil of Venezuela, but then also the lithium. And we can go on and on about the resources that exist, but obviously, like with all of these other commands and military practices that the U.S. has carved the world up into with over 800 military bases, and we just, Black Alliance of Peace just ended our month of action this October against AFRICOM, which is another U.S. military command doing very similar things, you know.
There's so many.
Yeah. You know, and all of it is around quote unquote security because it is the U.S.'s job to secure us all. Apparently. So, but what Operation Tradewinds does, I think it kind of collectivizes all of those different commands because it does pull together NATO forces in the U.S. And it's a SOFCOM-sponsored multinational military exercise. So it involves Caribbean nations, including Trinidad and Tobago. And again, it's framed for regional, quote unquote, security. So when a nation like Trinidad and Tobago can call for a state of emergency, it is doing that alongside this particular kind of training that occurs with SOFCOM military. So it's important to understand that these exercises are annual. They take part in different nations each year, and they also serve as a conduit, if you will, for U.S. military influence. So it's just another means to further militarize the Caribbean under this sort of guise of cooperation. So you hear terms like humanitarian assistance or, you know, combating transnational crime. You hear these kind of particular terms, but these are smoke screens for, you know, the objective of ensuring U.S. hegemony in the region. Also suppressing grassroots resistance. I think that's important to name too. And then to the point about tourism, protecting U.S. corporate interests. Because when you talked about Guyana, Exxon is very present in Guyana currently.
Yes.
Right? So I don't know. And around that is U.S. military, right? And the seas, also protecting its particular interests. So I think it's important that we note that. But these are exercises that are happening with CARICOM nations. CARICOM nations that proclaim currently that they want to keep the Caribbean a zone of peace, if you will, right? As they are inviting the U.S. military into its shores, into its waters, and essentially on its land yearly to train. So it's a mechanism to consolidate this sort of U.S.-led security kind of architecture that prioritizes their imperial control, again, over any kind of real socioeconomic reprieve. They're not really interested in that. And so I think this also speaks to Haiti. Mm. I do think Haiti is under-discussed when we talk about these things. Because even when we talk about crime, right? I think what is crime today was gangs last year, was violence before, right? So they're interchangeable terms that are being weaponized for particular reasons, for more U.S. presence, We see that the UN just passed the gang suppressing forces are allowed to be in Haiti. Again, we're seeing crises of imperialism. We're seeing crises of neoliberalism, right? But they're all being maintained by U.S. military or backed by U.S. military, right? Because in the case of Haiti, it is being backed by, you know, it is, Kenya's there. But it is a UN, US-led Kenyan mission, right?
It's the US that's the common denominator in all these issues in all these countries that you just mentioned. In the coming weeks and months ahead, I do hope to do a show on Guyana and its complicated relationship with its burgeoning oil industry as well, because that's another can of worms further down the road that needs to be addressed in one form or another. Now, I want to turn our attention to the issue of guns or the increase of guns in Trinidad and Tobago, because in addition to U.S. aggression towards Venezuela, can you tell us about how the increase of guns underscores the hypocrisy that you sort of described already of Trinidad and Tobago's arrangement with the U.S.? And just to clarify, we're talking about the Trinidad and Tobago government, not the people here who have made this arrangement with the U.S.
Well, to start, could we point to a gun manufacturing company in Trinidad and Tobago? Could we point to a facility in Trinidad and Tobago? Because they don't exist. So then the question becomes, you know, well, where are the guns coming from? And so the influx of firearms has been from the U.S. You know, the U.S. has named this. They're coming out of Miami more than anything. But it has been a major contributor to the nation's uptick in violent crime epidemic, if you will. And so it exposes, I think, a kind of profound hypocrisy, and I think you were naming that, at the heart of the U.S., that it can come in as savior for the things that it's actually causing. So with initiatives through South Columns, Operation Trade Winds, or these sort of advocation for increased militarization of the Caribbean to combat quote-unquote crime, it is the U.S. that is itself that is responsible for it. Its own domestic policies have actively enabled the problem. So, like, you know, lax U.S. gun laws here, you know, a powerful firearms manufacturer lobbies here allow for this prolific trafficking of weapons into the Caribbean. It is happening in Turks and Caicos. It is happening in Jamaica. It is happening in Barbados. It is happening in Haiti. It is happening in Trinidad and Tobago. None of these places have gun manufacturing facilities. None of these places manufacture weapons. So this creates a vicious cycle, a cynical cycle, if you will, where the U.S. is sourced weapons, right? They fuel violence and instability across the region. And then the U.S. offers itself as an indispensable partner to deal with these issues, right? Because the U.S. has the solution. The U.S. is coming in to save the day. So it kind of, it entraps the Caribbean into this sort of cycle of dependency and exploitation, right? Because now there's a belief that the Caribbean cannot save itself. The Caribbean has wonky leadership, you know? There's something wrong with Caribbean people. And that's the sort of narrative that gets proliferated by this, right? Now we're innately violent. Haitians are innately savage, right? But where this violence is coming from or how it's being stemmed from is not a discussion at all. Instead, the discussion is that these places need to be saved. So, you know, this is a crisis of imperialism. And this cycle of dependency and exploitation just ensures that the root cause of arms, the pipeline, it remains unaddressed. And U.S. hegemony and the neoliberal order continues to benefit from the destabilization of the region.
You know, as you describe this, it suddenly occurred to me that as the headlines right now in corporate media is about U.S. strikes on these boats off the shores of Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago, at no point in time have you heard any Trinidadian voices during the course of this conversation, of this debate in corporate media. And just to give you another example, as we're having this conversation right now, as you know, that a huge hurricane has devastated Jamaica. And if you look at CNN or MSNBC, the point of view and the voices that you hear about the devastation taking place in Jamaica is mostly from American voices and rarely ever from a Jamaican voice or a Caribbean voice, because this hurricane devastated several other islands in the region. And I think that same criticism also applies here with this escalation of military tension by the U.S. towards Venezuela, because to my understanding, there have been a few Trinidadian victims of these U.S. strikes on boats, which are clearly not drug boats. And right. I learned about it because Trinidad and Tobago Public Television has a footprint on YouTube, and you can find this information and you can see that there's resistance by Trinidadian people over what's going on, but you wouldn't know it listening to American media, which only focuses and prioritizes American voices here. So I want to address this because it's something that has infuriated me as the story continues to develop.
I think as of right now, because the U.S. just hit another boat in the Pacific, so that would be the 19th strike. There's been over 50 people that have been murdered with no real rhyme or reason other than the U.S. decided to murder people. There have been bodies, I think I named this earlier, that have come up on shore that have not been identified as of yet. So, you know, we're not sure if folks are Trinis, but there have been two that have been identified as Trinidadians or Trinobagians, if you will. And so a few things are happening with that identification. Before, I think the first, I want to say it's the first strike, but it might have been the second. But when Kamala spoke, and I'm not sure if this was a press conference or if she was just being interviewed for something, but she was very flippant about the death.
I saw that.
She was also... She implied that she hopes they blow them all up. And, you know, that's a very loose paraphrasing, right? Because that's basically what she was saying. And before that, I want to say she was also implying that anyone who was against the U.S. military on the Caribbean Sea was, in fact, themselves a criminal. Because the only people who would be against the U.S. coming to help them fight crime would be criminals. So when it was discovered that, or these two men were identified as being Trinobagians, one of them has online, at the very least, has already been, you know, the kind of same fresh we would get here if the police killed one of us, right? Then you start looking up their history. Oh, look, they were arrested 15 years ago. Obviously, they deserve to be blown up in the Caribbean Sea. So there's this sort of justification kind of thing that's happening that we're seeing. Also, UNC is refusing to directly speak about the deaths of two Trinidadians. They have not really answered for it. I want to say there was at least one who questioned how do we even know that they were Trinidadian, right? So this is the response from the government. The people, on the other hand, and I think a few things I want to note, because I do think that regionally what we're seeing is, I would say, is unprecedented or has not existed in quite some time. Because like I said, the Caribbean itself, and Trinidad and Tobago more specifically, has a labor movement history, has a resistance history. But it just, you know, the liberal policies through the 90s, through the early 2000s, a lot of these things wane or do not develop fully or not maintain as strongly. But what I have seen, especially in the last 2 years since El-Aqsa flood, is this pivot across the region. The way that Palestine has opened up grassroots movements across the region to put pressure on their own government around what was happening with Palestine, and has since allowed them to start questioning other things that government was doing, I think has set up for this moment where we're seeing loud calls from grassroots movement around zone of peace. And so when we talk about zone of peace as a concept, as a CELAC initiative out of 2014, Maurice Bishop talked about a zone of peace in 1983. This has been a call in the region for quite some time. The Black Alliance for Peace launched a campaign to kind of reassert the call for a zone of peace in our Americas from a bottom up, right? Because CELAC did it in 2014, but as we know, CELAC is members of heads of state, right? So what does it mean for that call to come from grassroots movement? And this is something that we launched in 2023. And so to see it reverberate so strongly across the region in ways that it hasn't in quite some time has been because these collectives have been in conversation with each other across the region because of Palestine, because of Haiti, and now because of Venezuela. So there's different conversations happening now, different conversations that are leaning more towards an anti-imperialist lens, you know, and not so much a humanitarian moral lens, but really kind of diving into what are our governments doing? What is CARICOM's purpose? Why is CARICOM so quiet? And CARICOM has only made a statement because the Thursday before was a regional day of action. And you've seen in Grenada, in Barbados, in Bermuda, in Antigua, in Trinidad and Tobago, in Guyana, across the region, in Suriname, pockets of grassroots organizations were taken to the streets. 10 to 20 at a time in some instances, 3 to 4 in some places, but it was a collective regional response to the U.S. invasion of the Caribbean and the Caribbean Sea. And then CARICOM says something.
That is incredible. Thank you for making that connection between the Caribbean and Palestine. And it just points out to me that I need to do more shows in the coming weeks and months ahead about the history of social justice and labor struggles in the Caribbean as well, because I think Latinos in this country need to know more about the struggle for social justice and labor movements in the Caribbean as well. We have about 5 minutes left, so I want to give you the last word. But before I do, I just want to let you know that we are going to create a link to your article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about Trinidad's role in U.S. imperialism. But in your article, I think this is probably the best way to end the conversation, is that if you could explain how the U.S. invasion of Grenada in 1983 serves as an important frame of reference that has perhaps hindered resistance movements throughout the Caribbean, but in recent times, based on what you just said, reinvigorated those same movements as well. It's a fascinating article. Again, we're going to create a link to this on our Twitter account because I did not know that the U.S. actually occupied Trinidad and Tobago around the time of the Second World War, which again, lends itself to the importance of learning more about these labor struggles and social rights movements in the Caribbean. But we have about 5 minutes left. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you raising that. If I could, there's a book called Caliban and the Yankees that speaks to the occupation of Trinidad and Tobago by the U.S. in that period of time. And then when we talked about tourism in the Caribbean, I also wanted to raise Jamaica Kincaid's A Small Place. It's a very brief book, but it really speaks to, I think, the colonial mechanism of tourism, especially as we see it today, given that context. But the occupation of Grenada, I think it's very interesting, or the invasion of Grenada, rather. I think it's a very interesting context to put in when we talk about where the Caribbean is today. Right? Because we also have to be mindful about the ways that folks are calling for a zone of peace, because there is some implication that everybody was for that. And I don't know, you know, I think the historical context of the invasion of Grenada shows that there has always, in many instances, been complicity with the U.S. against sovereignty. There has always been comprador elites that have existed throughout the Caribbean that have interfered. So the question about the invasion, I think folks, you know, obviously they talk about the relationship between Bernard Cornwell and Maurice Bishop and the history there and how Maurice Bishop, you know, end up murdered, and, you know, the collapse of that revolution. But I also think it's important to talk about the role of the surrounding Caribbean nations. Trinidad and Tobago, and I believe Belize, being the only two nations at the time to really not take a stake in that, you know, it also speaks to, well, what was Jamaica's role? What was, you know, Guyana's role? And so I do think it impacts how we really understand this sort of idea of togetherness that reverberates Trinidad's, well, the Caribbean broadly beyond, you know, behind this concept of carnival. Because even like in Trinidad and Tobago, you know, all of we is one, right? And that's kind of conceptualized thinking of how we are a connected people. And so we look at the invasion of Grenada as a sort of tipping point, I think, in terms of what does that mean to be a body, to be a regional body? What is CARICOM's role? You know, I think all these questions keep popping back up. But I think more significantly, what we're seeing with that invasion, and then more recently with the conversation about the U.S. wanting to put a satellite station or weapons station on Grenada's in the airport, or the Maurice Bishop Airport, and the consideration for that as a means to go after Venezuela, I think that these things are important because there is a significance to learning the history of the revolution of Grenada in that period. But I also think it's important to understand what was the role of the surrounding nations, because what's mostly discussed is what happened to Maurice Bishop, right? But I do not think that we can discuss what happened to Maurice Bishop as a singular thing and not a regional thing. Because what I talk about today, when we talk about what is Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua to the U.S. today, was once Cuba, Grenada, and Nicaragua. And so the role that these other nations have played in the collapse of that revolution, I think, is important to how we're understanding the role that they will play to the potential collapse of the Bolivarian Revolution. What is their role? And then what is the role of the people in these nations to ensure that that does not happen? Because to have lost Grenada was significant. And when you hear Maurice Bishop speak about it, when I talk about Cuba, Grenada, and Nicaragua, Grenada is the only English-speaking nation of the three, right? So what does it mean to be an African English-speaking nation forging sovereignty that close to the U.S.? And so when we lost that, that was significant. So I think that puts into question, what would the loss mean for Venezuela?
We don't know where this hostility between U.S. and Venezuela will land. But even if it were to end tomorrow, based on what you just presented to us, there needs to be serious, serious questions about this economic structure in Trinidad and Tobago that made it an enabler to U.S. imperialism. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Erica Keynes, who's a freelance writer and organizer in Baltimore and the DMV. She's also the field operations and membership coordinator of the Black Alliance for Peace. Her January article in the Black Agenda Report is entitled Bound by Imperialism, Trinidad's Role in U.S. Agenda. And again, we're going to create a link of this article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you for being on the show with us, Erica Keynes.
Thank you for having me.
You got it. And that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollector.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The Trump administration is appealing a federal judge's order for it to fully fund SNAP food aid benefits to states and do it today. The government previously said it would only restore partial benefits and only after the shutdown ended. Reinforcing his earlier decision, Judge John McConnell Jr. of Rhode Island issued the new order yesterday, saying the government failed to consider the harm to individuals who rely on those benefits. McConnell said, quote, "It's likely that SNAP recipients are hungry as we sit here," close quote. Vice President Vance called the ruling absurd because, quote, "You have a federal judge effectively telling us what we have to do," close quote. The Trump administration requested that the appeals court issue a ruling by 4 p.m. today. In more news, the Senate is likely to work through the weekend on whether to advance a continuing resolution to reopen the government, at least until sometime in January. Democrats have refused to support the resolution 14 times for its failure to include major investments in reducing health care costs, more specifically, a commitment to extend health subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. The current plan does not make that commitment, but is reported to come with a guarantee of a future Senate vote on extending the subsidies. It's not at all clear that Republicans will secure the votes they need to advance on the resolution, with a significant number of Democrats saying they will not go along with anything less than a guarantee to meet their demands, as opposed to a promise to address those demands at a later date. In more shutdown news, today, several airlines announced hundreds of flight cancellations as the government shutdown begins to affect travel. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Major airlines have been forced to cancel many flights out of specific high-intensity air zones. For you listeners out there in the D.C. area, Dulles, Reagan, and BWI have all been affected. This is in compliance with an FAA order, which aims to cut air traffic by 4% by tomorrow morning. The CEO of United Airlines released a statement where he agreed with the FAA that safety must be the highest priority. Airlines are offering free rebooking in order to aid customers and are stressing that the vast majority of their customers, even in affected areas, will experience no cancellations. But the longer air traffic controllers go without pay, the worse this problem will get. And with Thanksgiving only 2 weeks away, this problem could easily snowball. Cuts for this weekend's air travel will only be at 4%, but this will ramp up to 10% by next Friday, with potentially more cuts down the road.
And overnight, the Pentagon announced the 17th deadly strike on a boat in the Caribbean. Here again is Noah Portner with more on who has the power to order these attacks.
Yesterday, the Senate narrowly rejected a resolution which would require President Trump to ask Congress about any military action against Venezuela. The measure failed 51-49, with Lisa Murkowski and Rand Paul joining Democrats. Senator Paul has been especially vocal about the 17 deadly strikes on alleged drug boats. He believes the Senate has power over these matters and said, quote, "You really need to know someone's name. At least you have to accuse them of something," end quote. Indeed, the families of the men killed are completely left in the dark, as neither the U.S. or Venezuelan governments will acknowledge even their names. Those who know the deceased may also be intimidated into silence by Venezuela's dictatorship or criminal gangs. Several families had police search their homes after boat strikes. An AP reporter, Regina Garcia Cano, actually traveled to northeastern Venezuela and interviewed people who knew the deceased. Her report gives the impression that these men were trafficking drugs, but were far from violent criminals. It seems that most of the men she identified were only driving the boats for their first or second time, and were only doing it to survive. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.